welcome to Indie Media.
Hello.
Hello, we've got lots of people here today. We've got Geordie and we've got Andrew, just fresh from a court appearance. We've got Joe Wilding, very fresh from Baghdad. We've got Andrew, very fresh from his bed.
I thought you were going to say Brixton.
And we've got me, Penny. And coming up on the show today, we have stories from Reclaim the Bases and reports on the scandalous behaviour of the police in Oakland, USA, towards the US anti-war protesters there who were protesting against the docks carrying weapons. And obviously we'd like to welcome Joe Wilding, who I've just said has just come from Iraq. But first of all, we're going over to Andrew, who's got something he wants to say.
And the first track is a tribute to a great singer-songwriter. We've played cover versions of it, of this track on the show before. And this guy died last week, age 61. It's War, What Is It Good For? By Edwin Starr. And now on to a bit of global news. In America, wooden bullets, concussion grenades and pellet bags were used by police. On Monday, US police in Oakland attacked peace protesters as hundreds were demonstrating at the docks of American President Lines, APL, and Stephen Doring Services of America, SSA. SSA was awarded a $4.8 million contract for a year's operation in the port of Qusair in Iraq. The Oakland Police Department moved in to disperse the demonstrators using concussion grenades, wooden bullets, which are about the size of champagne corks. Beanbags full.
They're actually bigger.
Okay, bigger than champagne corks. Beanbags full of pellets and other munitions. Dozens of people, including six onlooking longshoremen, dock workers, suffered injuries, and over 35 other protesters and port workers were arrested. Police defended their actions, saying some people threw rocks at police. Many dock workers later went on strike and closed the port in protest. We have some audio now from that.
From a video of the events with the protest, which was posted to IMC San Francisco, which you can check out the video at sf.indymedia.org. Also posted was a piece by a young girl that actually went on that protest, and I just thought I'd read it out because it, I don't know, it was quite moving. It said, "Today I showed up for a direct action in Portland. I showed up for a direct action in Oakland to protest at corporations who make profits from war while children are dying in Iraq. We were told we were reinforcements for certain gates and asked to pile into vans and buses. When we reached the destination, the police had the access road shut off so we could not join the rest of the protesters. We all piled out of the vehicles and walked past the single policeman that was manning the roadblock. We walked quite a way, almost a mile, to meet up with other protesters who were enjoying a peaceful picket. When we arrived, we'd just been told that a dispersal order had occurred, but I heard none. All of a sudden, explosions were going off, smoke was seen, people were panicking, and the police were aiming what looked to be shotguns at people and shooting at the crowd in close range. It was the most barbaric display of violence that I have yet witnessed in my young life. It underscored the willingness of the state to use violence to obtain profits. The protest was completely non-violent and peaceful. We were blockading a corporation who profits from the war. The police showed their willingness to injure and attack the very people who pay them." Well, basically, she then goes on to say the flash grenades were the scariest because they were actual explosions. "I took 4 wooden bullets in the left side of my body, 1 in the lowest rib, in my chest, and 2 on my leg, which left my left knee looking like a grapefruit. The explosions of the flash grenades were going off only metres from their heads, and there was tear gas being used. Watching cops run up to a crowd of panicking people and aim at their heads and fire was a sight I will never forget. I saw a guy who got hit in the face with one of them, and he was really bloodied up. There were people with cameras, so you can expect some photos. And as I say, I mean, the photos are pretty horrific, so do check out San Francisco Indie Media.
And moving on to Irish anti-war protests, President Bush arrived in Belfast on the 7th. Protests were held at Hillsborough in Northern Ireland as Bush flew into town to meet Blair. For breaking news, CIMC Ireland. Approximately 3,000 people on the road from Sprucefield met lines of riot police at 7:20. Some arrests were made, at least seven. Hundreds of protesters staged a die-in in the centre of town and were removed by riot cops. As Bush arrived by helicopter, bikes not bombs arrived and locals called for troops to return home. People got into Hillsborough by the back roads and from the main demonstration. And the town centre was sealed off and bomb alerts closed all roads.
Well, that seems very interesting. Bomb alerts don't close the roads in Baghdad, do they? Now we're going over to Geordie and Andrew, and Geordie has some news from Barcelona.
Okay, yep. So, yeah, Geordie has been keeping up with the events in Barcelona, where actions and events are taking place daily since the invasion started. So what has been going on there?
Well, I mean, in fact, there is so much that's been going on. It's really difficult to sum it up. Basically, since this latest attack in Iraq started over 3 weeks ago, there's been a daily protest in Barcelona. Not a daily protest, rather daily protests all over the place. These protests, they have been growing in terms of numbers of people and also in terms of finding ways to do things and creativity and stuff. So basically the whole thing started like everywhere else, with big demonstrations organized by social forums or Stop the War coalitions and stuff on one hand, and then there was students on the other hand that, for example, they occupied the main motorways going south from Barcelona, which they stayed on the first day of the war. 15,000 students occupied the whole motorway for 8 hours, for example. Then, from then on, the protests started to become more spontaneous. Five camps sprout up inside the city. They are permanent peace camps. Five squares of the city have been occupied by people, in which one of them is, for example, is Plaza Sant Jaume, which is Piccadilly Circus here. It's the main square of Barcelona. This square is also becoming now a permanent assembly, in which people are assembling every night and are discussing ways to carry on the protest forward. For example, tomorrow there is a general strike in the city, which four anarcho-syndicalist unions have called for a 24-hour general strike, whilst more like reformist unions, the communist unions and socialist unions, are only calling for a 15-minute strike. But anyway, most of this strike has been prepared from the middle of the square and popular assemblies. There's 200, 300 people in downtown Barcelona talking about these things. Then there is another thing which is quite amazing, is like the idea of the Argentinian cacerolazo, which is like taking the streets with pots and pans and protesting. It's been taken to the level of it's happening now every day. So it's like you're at home and you know that by 10 o'clock you will start hearing this clang, 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 clang. Then the only thing you need to do is just get your pan or your whatever and go to the balcony and start banging it. Then people goes from the balcony down to the street, and it is continuous. So it is actually, people is telling me that for the first time they actually feel part of the majority. Is 94% of the people in Spain is against this war. That's the latest poll. And it's like people say, it's bloody hell, it feels like the 36 in Barcelona, really, kind of thing.
Okay. Thanks for the update.
It's okay.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Bypassing the corporate media machine.
Right, and now we're going to have a kind of discussion with Joe Wilding. As I keep saying, Joe Wilding has just come back from Iraq, and if you listened last week, you'd have heard that we read her diaries, which we all found really moving. And I think one of the things that we found really important about the diaries is when they were first being posted to the site, the mainstream media and the authorities were denying that there were hardly any civilian casualties. And now, as the reports are coming in, they're up to 3,000 a day and they're running out of anaesthetic. So we'll go over to Joe. How did you come to be in Iraq?
I went first in August 2001 when I was campaigning against the sanctions, and it just felt like the right time to go back in February. We went out to... I was going to act as a human rights observer and I was accompanied by an independent filmmaker.
And what sort of things did you see? What sort of things did you observe?
Well, before the war, it was really just spending time with people, seeing what was happening for them and seeing how they felt about the war. And then once the war started, we were going into... There were three hospitals that we went to regularly. The doctors would take us around, introduce us to the civilian casualties and their families, and we'd take witness statements from them. And then we'd go to the place where it had happened, take further witness statements and damage reports. And what we were seeing was quite a lot of civilian casualties who had been injured in attacks that just didn't make sense if you tried to look for a military target. For example, there was a family in one of the hospitals. They'd lost three members of the family and the rest were injured. And when we went to the farmhouse, the neighbours described seeing a plane circling overhead before firing three rockets, one of which took off the entire upper story of the house. And so you could only tell that it had been a two-story building when you went inside and saw that there were stairs. And we drove around looking for a possible military target, for something they could have been aiming at and just accidentally missed. But there was nothing. There was nothing but fields and farmhouses, just small fields and small farms. The family had one cow, a donkey and some chickens, and the cow had been crushed under the roof when the roof of the animal shelter collapsed. And it just made sense only if you looked at it as a deliberate attack. And people have actually criticised me for saying that there are deliberate attacks on civilians, but I can't understand it in any other way.
What do you think... Why do you think there is deliberate attacks on civilians? Because that's illegal, that's genocide, and...
Well, it's certainly a breach of the Geneva Conventions if it is a deliberate attack, or if it's an attack which is inevitably going to harm civilians. I don't know if I really understand why. The idea that we came up with was that if... This has certainly happened in other conflicts. If they attack civilians to an extent that civilians feel fear that they'll be injured in a war, their inclination is more likely to be to try and bring the war to an earlier end by rising up and getting rid of Saddam or whatever it is in a different conflict by themselves so that they're less likely to be injured. I don't know whether that's the actual reason, or it may equally be that individual pilots are flying around thinking, I'll just dump these weapons before I fly back. And this has been going on for years in the no-fly zones in the north and south of the country, that people on farms, people in residential areas have been hit with no apparent military target in sight. For example, a flock of sheep and some children herding them. And the last time I was there, I met a family whose son had been killed by a US bomb. It was the first day of his school summer holidays, and he was herding goats in the field in a mud brick village in the southern area of Iraq. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know why. I can't really explain why.
How did Baghdad look while the attacks were going on?
It varied, really. I mean, the first couple of days you saw nobody. Everything was closed in the central area of Baghdad. And things remained closed, but the cars and the people started returning to the streets after a while. The poorer parts of town, the Thawra district, which is also known as Saddam City, the markets were still operating. Everyone was still pretty much going about their business as normal. The smoke that was filling the air was mainly coming from trenches filled with crude oil and set on fire. And then after a couple of days, I'm sure you saw it on telly, the huge sandstorm, and everything, just the entire sky went orange. And it was the strangest thing I've ever seen. If you looked out from inside a building, it looked like the glass was tinted. But then you'd open the door and it was still exactly the same colour. It was just bright orange. And you kind of couldn't see through the daylight, and it blotted out the sun. And we actually went to see seven houses that had been destroyed in this one area. And it was just this crumbling kind of mass of rubble with a crater in the middle that was starting to fill up with water. And the wind was really fierce and the sky was bright yellow. And you couldn't quite see through the sky. It was just the most eerie kind of post-apocalyptic scene. We're kind of half expecting Mad Max to turn up on his motorbike.
So what did you... When you were over there and the invasion had started, you're obviously in Baghdad, so what kind of awareness was there in the city itself from people that, you know, it's coming to them?
Well, people knew there was a war coming. Before the war, there had been some people that would say, oh, no, there's not going to be a war. But a lot of people were expecting it for a long time, and they'd been preparing, storing food, storing water. And they'd been given their food rations in February for up to July. So people were kind of... They were taking home all the goods from their shops, bricking up the front of the shops in some cases. People during the war were getting information from... mainly from the radio, but there were four main sources. There was Iraqi State Radio, Voice of America, the BBC, and Radio Monte Carlo, and all four would be broadcasting completely different things. And so one of my friends said to me, an Iraqi friend said to me, everyone lies to us. You know, we don't believe what anyone tells us. So people didn't really know what was going on elsewhere in Basra and in the north, for example. And once the phones went down, people didn't really know what was happening the other side of Baghdad. Mm. And so people started to feel quite isolated. They couldn't find out how their families were on the other side of town, even.
That was another breach of the...
It's a potential breach, yeah. It's illegal to attack or destroy objects indispensable for the survival of the civilian population. So the big issue with the phones was that people couldn't call ambulances. Mm. So they were turning up at hospitals in private cars, which meant that they had been delayed in getting medical care. But even when they got to the hospital, as Penny mentioned before, even then they were running out of anaesthetics. They were conducting operations with arthritis painkillers. And there were no life support machines. So on one occasion we were in the hospital and a street had been bombed. And so people coming out of a mosque had been hurt, and one young man that was standing in front of his father's house. And three of them had just come out from major surgery, having bits of fragments removed from their bodies. One had a piece of metal lodged in the front of his head, and they weren't sure if it had pierced his frontal lobe. And there were no life support machines. And the other issue with the hospitals, even more than the doctors, is that there just aren't enough nurses. And so this one hospital where we were on that occasion had 120 nursing staff for a hospital that should have had 550. And so they were desperately short of just having those ordinary routine checks done. And so the doctors were having to do them, and they were having to show the family how to keep an eye out for the important signs. So it was really quite a desperate situation even then, before this huge kind of influx of civilian casualties of the last few days.
And like earlier you mentioned about the four main sources of news that people were listening to, and I guess you had a chance to listen to that news on occasions. Did you, where you were staying? If so, did you listen to, I suppose I'm thinking primarily the BBC, and how much, when you did hear that, how did that relate to what you actually saw?
We didn't actually have a radio, but what we did have was a sneaky satellite modem that we weren't really supposed to have. Right. And so we were able on a few occasions to check out the news on the internet. The internet went down on the mainstream quite early on, but we were able to get things like the Channel 4 and the Guardian and the BBC websites. Mm. Some of it tied up with what we were seeing, but really... The big thing was that the journalists, the mainstream media agenda was quite different from ours. So they would report on, say, the first house that was bombed, and maybe the next house that was bombed was a bit of a story. But after that, civilian houses being bombed wasn't a story anymore. The first market that was bombed was a big story. And I remember a flurry of excitement. I happened to be in the Palestine Hotel when the news came in, and there was a rumour that a hospital had been bombed. And the journalists were all so excited, and then... there was almost an air of disappointment when it turned out to be just another marketplace that happened to be near a hospital. And it was a very different agenda. They would report on what the information minister said, what the president said, what George Bush, Tony Blair had said. And what they were reporting wasn't so much the individual civilian casualties and the kind of the small-scale tragedies that were happening on every street.
Every day.
What I was going to ask is, in terms of humanitarian support, how could ordinary people help? Because we're seeing all these reports, we are starting to see pictures, and we're seeing the awful sensationalisation that's happening in the Mirror. And I'm just thinking, how could we help the people in Iraq as kind of activists, as ordinary people? What do you think we could do?
It is very difficult now to know what can be done from here, other than just keeping up the pressure to have the truth, keeping up the pressure on the government. Because I think there was a lot of talk before the war about this whole shock and awe thing, and people were really expecting the entire city to be completely flattened. And that didn't actually happen, certainly while I was there. And I think that there has been a lot of pressure. There's been much more intensive attention than has been previously the case. And so the governments of Britain and the US have felt less able to perhaps do exactly as they might have done otherwise. Certainly cluster bombs have been used, fragmentation bombs have been used in civilian areas. I don't know about depleted uranium, but I've certainly been told that that's been used. And I think it's important that we keep up the pressure, keep up the feeling that we are keeping an eye on what's going on, and keep up the pressure for the truth afterwards. Because I think what's likely to happen is that the so-called truth will come out, and it will be whatever the US and the UK want to be revealed as the truth. And there'll be people that want to avoid war crimes prosecutions who will testify to whatever they're told to testify to, be it that all those weapons were fired by the Iraqis or that this or that or the other happened before the war. So I think it's just really important now that we keep up the pressure and keep up the vigilance, but also to broaden our sort of understanding of how we came to this stage, because Britain and the US are not solely to blame. Saddam Hussein is entirely to blame for everything that he's done, but we've played a role in that. The British and American governments really encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iran in 1980 because they wanted to take on the Iranian government. They encouraged him to invade Kuwait because they wanted to take on the Kuwaiti ruling family. And the US was never going to have a financial hold over Kuwait, only a military hold. They prolonged the Iran-Iraq conflict by arming and funding and intervening for both sides. They inflicted 12 and a half years of economic sanctions, which were really enforced in quite a vindictive way. And certainly the Iraqi government wasn't entirely innocent in the suffering of Iraqi people, but an awful lot of it, if you look at the reports from even from the humanitarian panel of the Security Council itself, the suffering was caused by the sanctions. The Oil for Food programme couldn't and was never intended to deal with all of the humanitarian need. So the whole system was designed to create humanitarian need. And it's important that that is also recognised. And it's important that we keep focused on the whole context of the war, and that it's not just this war that's wrong. It's all wars that's wrong. It's war as a means of sorting out human problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, now mainstream media keep telling us that as the light troops walk into the cities, the civilian population is coming out, greeting them and stuff. But I mean, I suppose after having been bombed to pieces for like 3 weeks or so now, you don't really look at the people who's bombing you as liberators. What was the feeling you got from the people, the ordinary people, about American and British coming to the country? And how do you think ordinary people is going to take 1 year of American rule of Iraq?
Well, I think nobody really knows what's going to happen, but certainly what people were saying to me when we were able to speak openly, so that would be with people that spoke English, so there was no translator present. So that's a certain level of education, I suppose. But what people were saying to me was that they did want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but they didn't want the US to invade and do it for them. And a lot of people felt that over the years, the US had done so much to keep Saddam in power and had done so much to suppress their rights. And a lot of people seem to feel that the Iraqi government and the US and the British government were all on the same side. They were all abusing the Iraqi people. Mm. And that certainly seemed to me to be the case. I think that people are going to be very relieved when it's over, and you may well see the Americans and the British greeted quite warmly. That is a possibility, but certainly people said to us, well, they'll get in now because they've got this overwhelming firepower, but there'll be resistance later. And one thing that particularly concerns me is the level of debt and how that's going to be used to control the country, because over the last 12 and a half years, sanctions have been used to control the country. Previously, it was military aid and funding. Iraq has the highest external debt of any country in the world in terms of its debt-to-export ratio. It has huge, huge external debt, and that's increasing all the time with compound interest. I suspect that Iraq will be made to pay for this war against it as well, and that's cost a fortune. And that's going to come in the form of both the multinational takeover of its oil resources and the privatisation of the public services. So where now the Iraqi people don't pay any taxes, they have free healthcare, free education, electricity is heavily subsidised, fuel is heavily subsidised, water is free. I suspect they're going to be made to pay for all of those things, and that's happened in previous occasions, both where there's been a conflict or where a country's got into a lot of international debt. Structural adjustment is imposed in the form of privatisation of public services, shifting the burden onto individuals. And I think the Iraqi people are going to find themselves in even more terrible poverty than they're already in.
Right. Well, thanks very much for that. That was Joe. Is there any website you'd advise people to go to just to finish up for more information?
The electronic Iraq.net is maintained by people that are in Iraq now. There's also Iraq Journal and the Voices in the Wilderness website, vitw.org. You can also check out my website on
which is
www.bristolfoe.org.uk/wildfire/.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks
very much. Well done. We now have a track from Tragic Roundabout.
No, we don't.
We don't? What is it?
Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction.
Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you tell me.
Now we have a roundup of the actions and protests of over the weekend at the Reclaim the Bases Day 1.
Naval HQ Portsmouth, 120 anti-war activists gathered for non-violent direct action at the Naval HQ and shut it down by proxy as the MOD closed all the gates for the entire day. A banner was dropped from the harbour and one arrest made. USAF Fairford, severe restrictions in place. Around 100 peace campaigners took part in the sponsored terrorism act stop and search competition. Police blockaded off many of the access roads, and despite people's insistence that they had no intention of marching, the police organised a march themselves. At one point, police threatened to arrest people under Section 12 of the Public Order Act for not getting in a police coach to take them to the police organised demo. Activists and media were prevented from visiting the peace camp at Gate 10, which has been target of increased harassment. The competition continued on Sunday.
RAF Stafford. Following a vigil in Stafford Market, 120 anti-war protesters, including a 20-strong samba band, marched to RAF Stafford to the tactical support wing. The protesters gathered in front of the gates. They released doves for peace and attached anti-war messages to the fence. Devonport, Plymouth, 70 anti-war activists, 15 in white weapons inspectors' suits, staged a weapons inspection. They banged on the gates and hung notices recording that weapons inspectors were denied access to a base hosting illegal weapons of mass destruction, including at least 12 nuclear-powered submarines. Flying Dows, US Space Command, 60 anti-war activists flying foil kites and wearing foil clothes joined an anti-war demonstration at Flying Dows, part of the Star Wars system. Three people managed to find their way inside the base, well done. Two of them were ejected, the other one was arrested for breach of bow conditions.
Day two of Reclaim the Bases, anti-war actions took place at 9 military bases. USAF Fairford. As cluster bombs were being loaded onto B-52 bombers, over 100 anti-war activists at Fairford continued their sponsored stop and search with great success. The embarrassed police refrained from their regular practice of repeatedly stopping and searching people. Dave Cockcroft of Gloucestershire Weapons Inspectors said, "Creative action can bring about quick turnarounds in policy." RAF Megwan, Cornwall. 120 people protested against the war with 20 weapons inspectors clad in white suits requesting entry to the base. The protesters, including some nuns, laid dozens of red crosses at their entrance. Betty Levine of Cornwall Stop the War Coalition said, "Many people now feel it is imperative to do all they can to end the war as soon as possible. By resisting it to the best of their ability and to make it quite clear to the UK and US governments that we are not prepared to be complicit in what is, by all standards of international
jurisprudence,
a crime punishable under international law." RAF Welford. 15 activists took part in a sponsored stop and search like the one at Fairford. Unusually, police were reluctant to stop and search activists more than once. A die-in was held at the gates of RAF St. Athens. A cycle protest was held at RAF Broadley. Protesters planted seeds for peace at RAF Molesworth, and there were protests at both RAF Cottlesmore and British Land Forces HQ at Wilton. Meanwhile, 160 people travelled to Northwood military bases.
Northwood military base, civil liberties again suspended. As part of Reclaim the Bases, 180 protesters travelled to Northwood, Britain's military HQ, on Sunday the 6th of April. 60 protesters were illegally detained at Northwood tube station and then forced back onto the tube trains. Another 60 protesters were illegally detained in a pen outside the main gates to the base. Despite the mass policing operation, protesters demonstrated, some banging pots and pans outside the base. A group of around 20 evaded police roadblocks to reach the perimeter fence at the back of the base, but were chased away by police with dogs. Another group of around 20 protesters staged a sit-down in the road near the main gates. Six were arrested. Police applied pressure points to protesters and left some bleeding after dragging them across the street. Other small road blockades were also held on the other side of the base, and six women stripped naked in protest against the war and the police actions. At one point, the police kidnapped three people walking around the street streets near the base, drove them to the pen and forced them to join inside the pen where protesters were detained. Many others were physically forced into the detention pen even when they said they did not wish to join the protest. Up to 90 people will now file a formal complaint with the police for illegal detention. Similarly, many protesters are also planning a legal action following the illegal detention of three coachloads of people from London who tried to attend a demonstration at USAF Fairford on the 24th of March. Based on legal advice received by people at Northwood, there is no legal base for the police action. Shianne Jones of anti-war group D10 said, "All over Britain, police are increasingly abusing their powers to prevent people protesting against this war. This is an extension of the war to stamp out protest. While our government is breaking international law in Iraq by attacking civilians with missiles, cluster bombs, tanks and machine guns, they are also breaking human rights laws at home." Now we have some audio from the Northwood demonstration.
Just tell us a little bit about what's happened at the Northwood Reclaim the Bases action today.
Yeah, well, a group of about 10 of us were going for a walk anyway. So we arrived at Northwood and the road was all blocked off near the base. So we went for a walk in the woods and found ourselves around the other side of the base, which didn't have any policemen there at all for a bit. And then they arrived. We joined the main group and then everyone got detained in a designated demonstration area, but we weren't allowed to leave.
And what do you think of the police operation, how they've been with you today?
Well, it was similar scenario to the Fairford thing a couple of weeks ago, where we were basically being detained illegally because they didn't actually section 60 us, and they combined a couple of other sections, section 14 and section 12 perhaps. Some combination of it, but it was an illegal detention. It's going to be challenged in court, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Well done. Okay, we're talking now to one of the legal observers of the day of the Reclaim the Bases at Northwood. Could you just tell us a little bit about the legal aspects of what went on today?
Okay, what happened today is we arrived here and a number of people, well, quite a lot of people, I think about 50 people, sat down in the middle of the road. And what the police were doing to those people was dragging them out of the road and putting them into this sort of penned area at Pretty Corner. Six people were arrested for obstruction of the highway. And then we realised that gradually everybody was actually being put into this area in Pretty Corner. So we were wondering why that was happening. And suddenly we sort of thought to ourselves, oh no, they're doing the Sexton 60 cordon. Ah! So we sort of said, look, if you can get out of here now, get out of here, because it's a Section 60 cordon. So a large number of people eventually managed to get out, and there was only about 35 of about 100 people then left in the cordon. It turned out that actually it wasn't a Section 60 cordon, surprise, surprise. But what happened is that the police had apparently enforced a Section 14 order. That's one that limits the place of an assembly, and that the assembly should be at Pretty Corner. Now, we haven't actually seen that Section 14 order, and we're trying to get hold of it. So the basis on which 35 people were originally detained in a pen at Pretty Corner was under Section 14, combined with Section 3 of the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, in which they said they were detaining people so that they wouldn't commit a breach of the peace. Now, we've had a lot of legal advice about the inadvisability of the police using breach of the peace. It's been to the ECHR. A lot of judgments have gone against it because violence has to be offered if you want to arrest people breach of the peace. So they used those two pieces of legislation, and we're really not entirely happy about the way that they used those. They then also used the Section 14 order to unlawfully detain the majority of the people. What happened is that they went round the site rounding people up, and they then brought them back to the cordon.
And this kind of illegal jumping in a van and legislation that they're using to kind of effectively corral you and kidnap you and put you somewhere, that smacks very much of what they were trying to do in Fairford by hijacking the coaches. Is there a legal kind of campaign that's going to be working together on all this kind of stuff? Or
a lot of us are kind of sort of vaguely connected with some of the stuff that's been going on at Fairford and involved in documenting and monitoring some of the abuses of police powers that have been taking place there. For example, I was there last week, the weekend before last. I was searched five times under the Terrorism Act while just walking up and down the road carrying nothing. and no reasons being given particularly by police officers. So yes, for the searches, Section 44 searches, but for that, oh, you're carrying something up the road, no, just we said so, and we're actually going to physically obstruct you from going up the road. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely part of a whole continuum of abusive policing, which goes well outside the scope of constables' kind of powers and so on. And yeah, it does need to be challenged on all kind of levels, and certainly some of us are making formal complaints against the police and are trying to have sort of some kind of dialogue with the sort of senior commanders, because it's extremely abusive policing, and it's well outside the scope of a constable. So yeah, and we'd encourage anyone who's had this similar experience to make individual complaints against individual officers. So if you're stopped and searched, or if you're prevented from going somewhere, take the number of the constable, take the time it happened, consider putting in a formal complaint.
And if anyone wants to get in touch or hears this interview on the radio or sees it on Intermedia or whatever, if they're not sure about what rights have been infringed and where they can get advice, is there a number that they can contact?
Yeah, they can contact, we're the legal support for D10, but we're quite happy to help other people as and when we can, or refer them to a lawyer, because we're not lawyers, we're just the legal support people. But if people want some to chat to somebody, our telephone number is
07 887 585 721, or you can email info@the d10group.org.uk.
Thanks very much. Well done.
You're listening to Indie Media Radio London. Don't hate the media, be the media.
Right, it's goodbye for all of us here today. Just quickly, just to say, this Saturday sees April the 12th, the International Day of Anti-War Action. In London, there's another big demonstration. We'll assemble at 12 noon on the 12th of April with two new assembly points. Start A for people coming from South and London assembles York Road, Waterloo SE1, nearest tube Waterloo. Start B for the North assembles Victoria Street, nearest tubes Victoria and St James Park. Both marches will unite at Parliament Square and march to Hyde Park. Other things, there's marches globally. And tomorrow night, on Thursday, there's film showing at the Spitz venue in the gallery between 7 and 9. And it's free, but if you want to make donations, that's very welcome. The address for this is 109 Commercial Street, E1. The films to be shown are Trading Freedom, a look at the real effects of the free trade agreement and protests that have taken place surrounding the issues involved. And it's exciting and lively, and it makes for a really quick hour. CNN spoof roving reporters Dan Ankerman and Ivan Agenda do a special report on war and attend an anti-war demonstration looking for trouble that doesn't exist. Not content with that, they run around attempting to discredit the protest in any way possible. Quite a fun short film. It's also Films from Fairford, a film about people breaching the fence in January, and a Fairford film called On the Buses, when, as we mentioned on this programme quite a lot, when the police decided to kidnap the protesters. So it's goodbye from all of us.
Bye.
Ciao. Bye-bye.
And we're going to leave you with some excerpts from Peace Soup, a CD that's coming out from Schnooze. More info, www.schnews.org.uk, and some of the things that will be played in the next 10 minutes: Mark Thomas, DJ Rubbish, Monkey Mind, Attila the Stockbroker, and there's something like 27 tracks on it. Okay, see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Is everyone all right? Is everyone happy? Is everyone nice? Is everyone happy? Yeah. Yes, yes, that's good. I'm glad we're happy. That's good, because that means we're winning the war on terror. That's all we've got to do to beat terror. You see, he's put a gleeful sort of smile and push your hat at a Geordie angle. Maybe a little bit of Arthur-esque. It's just funny. I love the war on terror because it's an abstract. How can you have a war on terror? Yeah, how do you fight? Boo! Oh, fuck off. Look you up. It's just an abstract, isn't it? I think we should have more wars on abstracts. I want a war on clutter. That's what I want. A war on uncertainty. That's what I want. That's right. A war on uncertainty is piece of piss. You just don't have to be right or wrong. You just have to be sure. So the thing about... I was trying to work out how you actually fight a war on terror. Because it's such an abstract... It's jazz, isn't it? It's a bit jazz. It's a bit free-form jazz. Is it, hi, my name's George Bush, I hope you like our new direction. This is improvised war. I would like some suggestions from the audience to assist us. Can I have a geographical location and an excuse to bomb?
Yeah, I'm just going to run through a few of these so we understand what we're dealing with. If we don't succeed, we run the risk of failure. George W. Bush. Welcome to Mrs. Bush and my fellow astronauts, George W. Bush. This one's very true. Check it, because this one's from 98. Understand he's got some fucking foresight. He understands what's going on. I believe we are on an irreversible trend towards more freedom and democracy. But that could change. And it did, yo. And it did, yo. I have made good judgments in the past. I have made good judgments in the future. George W. Bush. Love this one. People that are really very weird can get into sensitive positions and have a tremendous impact on history. George W. Bush, welcome. I am not part of the problem. I am a Republican. George W. Bush. Public speaking is very easy. George W. Bush. I think he meant saying the words public speaking are very easy because he'd been practicing for a long time. Check the rhyme. Step up, my youth.
I will not be answering questions in English, French, or Mexican. Bush.
Bush! Sit on your tushy and listen. Oil pipeline, oil pipeline. They wanna put an oil pipeline through Afghanistan. 3 trillion.
We're gonna find it and bring it to justice. Justice, bring it to justice.
Bring it to justice. You know how I bust this? Bring it to justice. Twingy twang, twingy vegetable, making your mind rot like a vegetable. It's the final countdown. Time's ticking, clock's ticking away. Running out of words, don't know what else to say. I hope atomic weapons don't take us away. Wanna see another fucking day. But do I really seriously think that we deserve to continue in the way that we're going? As global capitalism runs rife and everybody's not knowing, and we get squeezed for everything. We get squeezed for G's, we get squeezed for keys, we get taxed everything, and we're dropped to our knees, and we suck on the cock that the fucking government feed us. All that cum coming down into our face. Believe us, Jesus. We must overcome this rubbish. We must overcome this rubbish.
In eastern skies the great hawks fly, over bloodied hills where children die, and the instruments of tyranny were bought from Britain PLC as the war machine goes round. And the war machine goes round and round, and the poor and the weak get trampled on the ground. And from where we stand, their cries are drowned by the clink of the franc and the dollar and the pound as the war machine rolls round. And the prisoner sleeping where he fell will awake to one more day of hell from a U.S. mountain steering pain. His body bound by a Sheffield chain as the war machine rolls round. And the war machine rolls round and round, and the poor and the weak get trampled on the ground. And from where we stand, their cries are drowned
I used to live in a little-known street in Brighton called Taliban Terrace. There's a gnome sat in my garden who resembles Osama bin Laden. Yeah, I know it sounds quite weird, but he's got a silly hat and a beard. And he ain't holding a fishing rod. No, it's a fucking Kalashnikov. And it might have fooled the Americans, but I know his videos were mockery. He ain't broadcasting from Afghanistan. No, he's sitting on my rockery. And the CIA think it's frightening that the axis of evil includes Brighton, and my garden, the Pentagon has declared, is a legitimate target for air warfare, and the telly's telling me it's justified, as evidence linking me has been found. They've discovered my dog's an Afghan hound. The neighbours won't speak to me no more as missiles hit my garden shed. They've had to flee as refugees or they're collateral damage and dead. And I don't have much of an air force. The US bombed my geraniums. There's lots of radiation, of course, because they use depleted uranium. Now my lawn is quite a sight. It's 40 foot tall and glows at night. George Bush is totally raving. He's as mad as my crazy paving, because you don't have to be too bright to know that two wrongs don't make a right. Oi, George, two wrongs don't make a right.